You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 17th to the 23rd of July 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, deputy news editor John Morgan, and books editor Karen Shook. David Willetts has been Minister of State for Universities and Science since May 2010. That is until he stepped down on Monday evening. All change then for universities in Westminster as Greg Clark gets the HE in Science role. More on the end of the Willetts era in just a moment. Are you fortunate enough to be going on holiday this summer? A chance to get stuck into a good book, perhaps. Our 2014 summer reads are revealed this week. Scholars and senior sector figures let us know what books they've chosen to devour while on holiday. Karen will reveal a little bit more just shortly. And a new scheme has resulted in a series of Anglo-Israeli scientific collaborations. That's against the backdrop, of course, of a campaign for a boycott. Matthew Rice reports from Israel in one of our features this week, and we'll hear a little bit more from him at the end of the podcast. First off, though, David Cameron's cabinet reshuffle. David Willetts had the HE brief for 7 years, if you count the time he spent as Shadow Secretary for Innovation, Universities and Skills. John Morgan, it's the end of an era of sorts.
It is. He's been in charge of Tory policy on higher education since 2005, actually. So that's a long spell, including his years in opposition. And we spoke to him the day after he'd announced that he's quitting ahead of the reshuffle. And not surprisingly, he was keen to defend his legacy, particularly answering sort of questions about the two sort of key concerns about his time in office, which were the affordability of the student loan system and the overspend on private providers as well. But overall, he was saying that there was no other model other than the fees model that he'd introduced that could have delivered more cash for universities in a time of government austerity. And you would have to say that compared to other parts of the public sector, which the universities are kind of, they probably have come out of the years of coalition austerity with a good settlement compared to other areas of government spending.
He was also there at the time of the big fee rise, of course. And it's interesting, Gove went on the same day. Gove often the subject of animosity from teachers. But Willetts perhaps less so in the academic sector. Is it sort of a testimony that it's not just what you do, it's the way you do it and the way you say things that counts too? Because he was always a Twitter's anything to go by, sort of regarded as a fairly polite politician.
It was interesting, wasn't it, that in the reshuffle, and I mean other people have made much of this already, but that the kind of big reformers of the government so far all went. So Gove, Andrew Lansley on health and David Willetts on HE, who have had sort of success or failure to differing degrees in their areas, but they've all gone now. And I suppose that's perhaps a reflection of, you know, these really big reforms that happen do inevitably sort of toxify the individuals who are in charge of them. I think with David Willetts, there was this sort of strangely schizophrenic approach to David Willetts, wasn't there, where people sort of almost universally respected and liked him for his personal qualities and his ability to sort of listen and engage in debate in a way that chimed very much with sort of, you know, the academic way of doing things. And yet an awful lot of people think the policies that he's introduced have been disastrous and also probably are quite unsustainable. I mean, I think one of the things that he would say about his reforms, probably, I don't know what you think of this, John, but there's kind of three things that he could look at when he came in. You had sort of fees, student numbers and the unit of resource. And if you've maxed out fees at 9K and that was, you know, a cap that was put on and couldn't really be touched, the other two aspects are student numbers and the unit of resource, and he has managed to protect both of those. I think, you know, previous Conservative governments will probably in other circumstances might have gone after one or other of those things, and David Willetts would make the argument that actually universities are better off, they're receiving more funding per student now than they did previously, and student numbers haven't just been protected but actually are set to expand. How that will pan out remains to be seen, but it's an interesting mixed legacy, and I think probably very, very mixed feelings amongst our readers and the sector generally.
Absolutely. The new guy, of course, is Greg Clark. He becomes Minister for Universities, Science and Cities. Is that now confirmed? That appeared to be the job title on the day the change was made.
Well, Biz is still unable to confirm whether that's his actual official title, although he is describing himself on Twitter as Minister for University Science and Cities, so it seems like there's some confusion over that still. But it is very unusual, this dual role where he's still got another ministerial post in another department. So there are some concerns already within the sector over whether that's spreading himself too thinly and kind of maybe downgrading the post of Universities and Science Minister. People saying that actually there will be quite a lot of to do in the higher education post, even though there's no legislation. There is the implementation of the abolition of student number controls for 2015, and there's the getting to grips with private colleges and the problems that David Willetts has left there, and also tensions with the Home Office over student visas. So there will be quite a lot on his plate. So will he be able to sort of wrestle with the two roles? But looking on from the other perspective, possibly you could say it's quite a positive to link Universities, Science and Cities. It fits in with kind of the broader agenda on city deals, which Greg Clark has been in charge with in his Cabinet Office post, which are about sort of increasing investment in certain cities that have a plan for economic growth, and universities have been heavily involved in some of those. So you could say there is a logic there, but possibly that might be investing the government with more of a strategic plan than they really have.
There's also a new a slight refocusing, isn't there, of the science part of the brief, in that they've split the science role, so there's a Minister for Life Sciences as well. Well, I don't know what the significance... Have you spoken to anybody about that, John, in terms of the significance? I suppose life sciences has been a very... an area that the government sees us as being a kind of leading light on, and lots of money to be made as well, presumably, they think, from life sciences. So,
I think... Given that there's a joint role between the Department of Health and Biz, I think some people might worry about the budget also being split, because there was some suggestion in one of the rounds of budget crises recently that some of the research budget might be hived off to the Department of Health, which would be a worry, because see, the NHS suffers from regular periodic crises. So would some of that, if there is going to be funding, split funding as well, would some of that funding end up being used for other purposes if it does go to the Department of Health?
I think the cities part of the role, actually. You know, if you think about the 130 universities we have in this country, an awful lot of them, you know, a vast proportion of their focus and energy and resources and, you know, student body and all the rest of it is local to the region that they're in. And often that's kind of the only thing that particular city might have, is a university that's really, you know, really scrapping away and trying to make something of a town and sort of, you know, actually invest in that area. So I think that's, at face value at least, I mean, it remains to be seen how it pans out, but at face value that seems like a fairly positive thing to have brought into the brief.
Absolutely. Well, our journalists have been working very hard. Page 6 and 7 in the magazine this week. There's also lots of coverage online. We also used our Twitter account to get your views on this. One of my favourites actually was from Smita Jamdar, an education lawyer at SGH Martineau. She tweeted a little poem. It goes, "So farewell, Mr. Willetts. You promised an HE bill. It's a pity we had to wait, and now it is too late for you." Lovely there, very poetic. So, Karen, this week includes the first THE Summer Reads. What's this all about?
Well, it's astonishing that we haven't done one. Obviously, pretty much every magazine and publication has a Summer Reads or Books for the Summer feature, but who better to have it than the magazine for the higher education sector, since
Absolutely.
The one thing that links all academics is their bibliovore tendencies. So you can be sure that our Summer Reads is brainier than the rest. The senior scholars we have include Prue Shaw, Lynn Segal, Philip Roscoe, Martha Nussbaum, Evgeny Morozov, Tessa Hadley, Connor Geraghty, Danny Dorling, a name in the news, Bradley Garrett as well, Linda Colley, and some senior sector figures, including Alistair Allen, the Minister for Learning in Scotland, whose reading Scotland's Future, their 649-page guide and manifesto, just in case there's anything he's missed, and Hugh Lewis, the Minister for Education in Wales, who says he might be reading To Kill a Mockingbird, since this was obviously a jab at the former Minister for Education, Michael Gove. The interesting thing about asking academics about what they're reading over the summer, of course, is that with academics being so busy and the summer being this big drawer where you shove everything you can't do the rest of the year, and it's often not a holiday in the sense that other people have holidays, or so I'm told, that one suspects that the book reading that goes on throughout the year just sort of spills over into the summer. So needless to say, I didn't invite anyone to ask me about Bonkbusters, airport novels, or chick lit novels, but nobody volunteered them either. Lots of people are planning to read Thomas Piketty, or Piketty, still not sure how I'm supposed to pronounce that, and his massive tome.
Have you read
on
it?
No, I haven't looked at it though. I've stroked it in bookshops, I've looked at it, I've sent it out for review, so I like to think that's close.
Do you tell people you've read it?
No, I haven't. No, I've figured not, because they will ask me. A couple of people wanting to read the new translation of The Second Sex, the Simone de Beauvoir. And interestingly enough, one of our contributors in Canada is reading one of Linda Colley's books, Britain's Forging the Nation, thinking about the issue of separatism and the referendum in Scotland. And of course, that's particularly germane for Canadian scholars, since we've lived through two of those referendums. There's loads of books in here. Practically any academic will look at it and their fingers will tingle with wanting them all. Like I said, if you ever need to get an academic into a room, just a trail of books, you'll get them in.
Are you a harsh taskmaster? Do you survey afterwards to see how many of these people actually found the time and follow?
I'll be sending through a brief questionnaire.
I was going to say, it's fascinating, but how much of it is grandstanding?
I don't think it is. I really don't think it is. I suspect that is the case when you're asking, not to be too scornful, but celebrities or public figures in other magazines, everyone has their PA run out and find a book that looks plausible and mention it. But the one thing we do know about academics is they read lots of books. Mm-hmm. These are only two out of a huge list of things they have to read and want to read, whereas, as I say, in other magazines, you suspect the last time they read a book might have been A-levels.
It reminds me of, there was a piece on Radio 4 the other day where they were interviewing politicians about the books they read, and they all say Piketty as well. And they had a couple of experts on. Actually, I don't know how expert they were. I think Edwina Curry was one of them, saying that they should all be reading, you know, latest Wallander book or whatever. And actually, that's what will free your mind and allow you to think great thoughts, rather than sitting on the book reading. Sitting on the beach reading. Actually, I better not pick one of these. I'll offend somebody. But you can look for yourself.
Of course, the whole issue of people having Kindles has taken away the ability to impress people with a big weighty tome. So, you know, that was one of the reasons they said that the huge spike in sales of 50 Shades of Grey was that you could read it without people knowing what you were reading, lest, you know, someone look askance at it. So I'm wondering whether, you know, they'll start doing Kindle covers that, you know, that actually reading Thomas Piketty, and I'm on page 437 already.
I've almost read 50 Shades of Grey, just from reading over people's shoulder on the commuter train in the morning.
Well, leave that one there, John. around about page 50 this week. You'll see it in the magazine. Now, almost everything about Israel is controversial, but few would dispute that its universities are dynamic, high-tech, and internationally minded. That's a quote from Matthew Rice's article. He visited Israel earlier this year and reports in this week's edition. And I spoke to him a little bit earlier to find out what he found out. Matthew, you visited Israel recently as a guest of the British Council, where you heard about Anglo-Israeli scientific collaborations. Of course, this is all against the backdrop of an academic boycott of Israel by some organisations. What did you learn while you were out there?
Well, I think I learned that the big Anglo-Israeli collaborative project in regenerative medicine, I think it would be hard not to be impressed by the scale and the ambition and the enthusiasm of the researchers, and obviously the research is in, you know, life-saving areas of medicine. So there is a very interesting stuff going on there, and the delegation included a lot of vice chancellors who are clearly keen to develop further collaborations with Israeli universities in these and indeed other areas. So, and the Israeli Academy has some of the same problems as the British Academy. People gripe about pensions and funding and so on everywhere. But there are also very specific issues, both the lot of pressure for a boycott from outside the country, and also a lot of the more left-wing Israeli academics, which includes a very large proportion of the academy, get very irritated by pressure on them to kind of toe the official Zionist line, I suppose. There's a lot of pressure on not being too critical of their own country when it's being so strongly criticised from outside. Mm. And it's maybe less, slightly less now, but there were people who were talking about a sort of McCarthyite environment within the academy. So I was looking at I used this important Barracks conference as a way to look at some of these other issues. And of course, if you talk to people in the Israeli academy, most people are not particularly sympathetic to people wanting to boycott their own country, though a few were in the early days. But people disagree very strongly about how significant, how effective the boycott is. Some say it's just a lot of people, there's a lot of hot air, and a lot of vice chancellors and others want to do business with Israel, and others are more worried about it. So. Both the ethics and the effectiveness of the boycott are very much under discussion in Israel as elsewhere. So it's certainly a very interesting place to visit. Lot of argument about everything, which kind of inevitably touches on higher education as well as just about everything else.
Mm. It's relaxed a little bit though, hasn't it? In recent years, I noticed in your feature it hark back to an age where if any students wanted to write in English, they had to seek approval in order to do that. But, the sort of age of the international student being, king, that sort of some of those things have relaxed quite a lot, haven't they?
Yes. I mean, I think Israel, like a lot of other countries, they're putting on more courses in English, and there are obviously very obvious financial reasons for that. And Israel is a country where there's a very high level of English speaking. But there's also this notion that Israel is, revived the ancient language of the Bible, and therefore everything should be in Hebrew and so on. So there's a kind of political debate about that, which I think there probably isn't in other countries, in Holland or even in Turkey. If people put on courses in English, they see, everyone understands why, and it's not a particularly political issue, but there it gets rather more contentious than it might elsewhere. Mm. I mean, in writing this piece up, I didn't get into the big ethical issues about the separation fence and the settlements and so on. What I did look at is the situation for the Arab minority, who are citizens of Israel, and how well universities are widening access to them. And they're certainly, they've got a long way to go, but there are some important initiatives there. So I did discuss that one aspect of the broader issue. And there's also the issue of whether of more and more ultra-Orthodox Jews go to university. Traditionally, they went to separate religious colleges, and they are now going to universities in much larger numbers, with some intriguing consequences there.
And I understand you're due to head out, hopefully, to Palestine at some point as well this year.
I very much hope to visit Palestine soon. It's not, doesn't seem the quietest moment, but I hope that, obviously I hope that things are going to get better soon, and I would very much welcome the chance to go there.
How was the trip in general? I mean, I know when you go to universities anyway, in the UK included, you can be sort of shepherded around quite closely, and they they show you the bits that they want you to see, and not so much there's not much freedom often to just go and speak to who you want to speak to. Were you able to sort of get a real sense of what it was like in these universities that you visited?
Well, I think I've got a fairly good sense. I mean, I was in the labs, which were very very exciting place to visit. In fact, David Willetts was a particularly enthusiastic, he was like the sort of star pupil at the back of the class, asking all the questions. It was quite an interesting sight. But I think on the whole, Israeli academics are pretty outspoken, and they're often very, very critical of their government and so on. It's not as if no one was. I didn't feel I was getting some sort of official line too much.
Very good. Well, that's a feature in this week's magazine. The other feature is one that I wrote myself, actually, about some of the leading universities in the world that are aged under 50 years old. That's off the back of our 100 under 50 world university ranking. So you'll find that in the magazine as well this week. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on either of those features or indeed anything else we've discussed in this episode, then you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us in all the usual social media places, on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, even on Google+. So do get in touch if there's anything you want to say. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.